From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Our guest today holds the title of special correspondent at NPR, but if you're an All Things Considered listener, you will probably recognize her voice as the one paired with Robert Siegel for more than a decade, from 2003 to 2015. 2 years ago, she stepped away from the anchor desk to immerse herself in feature reporting. Over the course of her 32-year career at NPR, Melissa Block has covered domestic and international news, including the massive 2008 earthquake in China and its aftermath. That reporting earned her and NPR broadcast journalism's top honors, including a George Foster Peabody Award, DuPont Columbia Award, and Edward R. Murrow Award, among others. She is with us in Wilmington, although it's not her first rodeo here. We'll learn why during this hour. But that said, I am over the moon to welcome Melissa Block to Coastline. Melissa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rachel. It's great to be here.
And this is a pre-recorded edition of Coastline, which means we are not taking listener questions on this Thursday. Melissa Block, you started at NPR in 1985 as an editorial assistant for All Things Considered. Moved into the role of senior producer, but you didn't jump into the role of reporter for 9 years. How did that evolve? Did you know when you were a wee thing that you were going to become a reporter?
No, I really didn't. And I sort of fell into the job at NPR. It wasn't something that I had ever dreamed of doing, although I really was interested in journalism. But I assumed I would be working for a magazine or a newspaper and met somebody who worked at NPR who had a job of setting up interviews for the hosts of All Things Considered. And as he described it, you know, you get on the phone and you call people and talk to them. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I started as a booker, or they called it desk assistant at the time, booking interviews for Noah Adams, who was then the host of All Things Considered, and Susan Stamberg as well. And then just very quickly started learning production, which back in the day when I started, it was 1985, meant cutting tape, literally cutting tape, razor blades and splicing tape, and just loved sort of getting my hands dirty on putting stories together and figuring out that puzzle of how to create narrative structure and going out on the road with the hosts and producing pieces from the road. And then, as you mentioned, was the show producer for All Things Considered for 3 years, which meant driving that train every day, getting what was a 2-hour program on the air, and figuring out what stories would go in, how long they would be, who would do them. It's a really, really fun job. It's an adrenaline rush every day, but it's exhausting. And just started feeling at that point that I really wanted to flex different muscles and moved to New York, ultimately, to be a correspondent for NPR based out of our New York bureau at, you know, fascinating time. That was 1994. Stayed there till 2003, so obviously overlapping with 9/11 and all sorts of other news in New York at the time. And also just what a great place to be a reporter, because everybody in New York loves to talk. And they all have great stories to tell. So it's sort of just like a candy store. You can just, you know, walk down the street and find something amazing to tell.
And then how did that lead to arriving at the anchor desk?
Well, they called. I had just had my daughter. It was 2002. She was a couple weeks old, and the phone rang, and it was the executive producer of All Things Considered saying, "Hey, how'd you like to come be the host of All Things Considered?" Which I had applied for, but it had been a long time, and I was a little bit consumed with other things happening in my life at that point. And I remember sort of looking at the phone like it was an alien object and saying, "Jonathan, can I get back to you about that?" And just hung up the phone and burst into tears, because at that point it was really all I could do to manage, you know, getting my child diapered and fed, much less thinking about hosting a national news program every day. But and moving with a new husband and a new child to a new city. Not new for me, but it would be new for them. But what an amazing opportunity. I mean, how could you ever say no to the chance to host All Things Considered? So up we went. So I started hosting when Chloe was about 6 months old. And so she kind of grew up with her mom in the host chair. That was the life she knew. And it's the show that, you know, I'm a lifer at NPR, and that was the show that I cut my teeth on. So to be able to come back and be in the anchor chair was just a great, great gift.
And certainly your time as a producer of that show, understanding it from that sort of bird's eye view, must have helped a lot.
Yeah, I think everything I did leading up to that point shaped who I was as a host and who I am as a reporter. I mean, I approach things very much as a producer. I'm thinking about sound. I'm thinking about ways that sound will move the story forward and really embracing the medium that is radio, which I adore. You know, I think even just having booked interviews for this show helps me understand the role in a different way. All of those experiences, having directed the show, knowing a clock, I'm hoping that I keep to time on this, on our conversation today, but sort of having an internal clock, because when you direct All Things Considered, everything is down to the second. All those things, you know, play into what I did then and what I do now.
And certainly putting on a show that's as produced as All Things Considered and as well thought out and highly regarded is quite a project 5 days a week. So the pace is certainly understandable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was 2 years ago that you decided it was time to move away from that and move back into the world of being a correspondent. How did that evolve and why?
Well, you know, 12 years is a long time. I mean, it's a fantastic job, and it's an amazing perch to be in the middle of the news every day. But it's pretty exhausting. And I think there's something to be said for being able to step back and spend more time on projects, not have the pressure hanging over you all the time. Because it's not just when you're in the host chair, it's what you bring home with you, as you know, every day and every night and every weekend. Again, a tremendous gift, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to have done it for so long. But it's also a really welcome opportunity to be able to step back and get out in the country and do reporting and just spend more time thinking about things and, frankly, more time seeing my family.
You're listening to a pre-recorded edition of Coastline. NPR special correspondent and former All Things Considered host Melissa Block is with us today. Recently, Melissa Block, you've been working on a series for NPR called Our Land.
Uh-huh.
Can you, before we get into some of the pieces that you've done for that series, can you kind of explain the idea behind that?
Yeah, and this is something that I'm so excited about and so glad to have a chance to talk about. So the series originated mostly after the 2016 election, when I think a lot of us were thinking about ways that we could explore voices around the country, maybe hear from people that we don't often hear from. But it's also, frankly, the kind of stories that I love to do and have always, since I've been reporting, tried to shape my reporting career around. So what it has involved, the idea behind the series has been to explore how place shapes identity and how where people are from really shapes who they are and how they see the world, which gives you a lot of latitude to go just about anywhere and talk to anybody about just about anything. Originally, I think we had thought that it might be more overtly political, more directly tied to the election, and I pretty quickly decided that that wasn't what I thought I would be best at doing or what would be most interesting both to me and to our listeners, that there was a fair amount of tune-out factor, I think, for a lot of people, especially after the election, which had been so partisan and so bitter in so many ways, that there was a real opportunity, I thought, to step back from that and really think about bigger questions about, you know, who we are, what issues are important to us, what shapes our life, what are our hopes for our kids in the future. So it's meant a pretty incredible road trip, intermittent, not consecutive. I think originally I had an idea that I would somehow manage to circumnavigate the entire United States and come out at the end of 4 months with some grand conclusion. And instead, it's been much more, let's find an area that's really interesting to us. We'll go there. We'll spend a concentrated amount of time and find people and characters to profile who are really interesting and compelling and tell us something about who we are. So we've been we started in the Midwest. We started in Kansas and Missouri and Iowa. I had the idea that I'm a total map geek. So I was looking at a map and somehow it just jumped out at me that you could drive from three places that were all called Independence. Independence, Kansas, Independence, Missouri, home of Harry Truman, and Independence, Iowa. And I thought, well, that's a road trip right there. And what a great sort of theme to unite these pieces. Well, it turned out nobody could really explain to me in a compelling way why they were called Independence. So that sort of through line didn't really end up bearing fruit. But still, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of driving, as it turned out, to get from Independence, Missouri to Independence, Iowa was a long haul. But I'm glad we did it. We did cover a good section of the middle of the country.
So this came from the 2016 election,
it did,
you said,
yeah.
Which was for so many people more vitriolic, maybe, than we had remembered.
Yeah.
But there was also, I think, a lot of people in what we would identify as the mainstream media were surprised by the results. And there was a lot of, I think, post-election shock among members of the media who went, oh, we weren't listening.
Mm-hmm.
We missed it. Is that part of what this is about?
Well, I think we were all doing some reckoning after the election. But I will say that I think NPR, more than just about any news organization I can think of, was really attuned to what was going on around the country, partly because we have so many reporters based at stations like this one around the country who are tapping into what's going on locally. But look, I mean, the polling was misleading. I mean, every indicator of how that election was going to go just about was off. So we were not alone in being surprised on election day, I think. Certainly the campaigns were surprised. But yeah, I think there was just an interest in, you know, something's going on out there, and let's try to figure out some of what that is. I wouldn't say that the stories that I've done are directly in answer to that question, but there definitely is an interest that I have in exploring the currents that are running through the country right now and the issues that people are really excited about or really angry about.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with NPR special correspondent Melissa Block. She is our guest today. And when we come back from this break, we're going to find out how Melissa Block pulls back the curtain to get her best interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You are listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with NPR special correspondent Melissa Block, who spent 12 and a half years in the anchor chair for All Things Considered in Washington, D.C., and lately has traveled the country for an NPR series called Our Land. This is a pre-recorded edition of Coastline, so we are not taking listener questions on this Thursday. Melissa Block, just before we went to break, we were talking about Our Land and the idea behind it. You recently returned from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that experience. That's not a place many people get to visit.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I have been to Alaska twice before, once on a reporting trip to the far, far north, Barrow and a little island where you probably actually can see Russia, St. Lawrence Island, for a series about climate change, which was fascinating. But I've never been to the southeast of Alaska. So if you're thinking Alaska is sort of like a hand, and if you stretch your thumb down at the bottom, it's the thumb. It's the panhandle of Alaska. And it's a part of the state that is not connected by road for the most part. So if you want to get around, you're on a boat or a plane, which always excites me. So we were in Juneau and a little town called Haines and Sitka and Ketchikan and then a teeny, teeny, teeny little fishing village called Myers Chuck. Tiny, sometimes only two people there in the winter, and they have one post office, which when I saw the picture of the post office, I said, I am going to Myers Chuck. No matter what I do, I want to get there. But it's a place. I mean, if my series explores place and identity, I think nowhere has that felt more strongly than in Alaska and in this part of Alaska in particular, because you are so connected to the sea and to the land. A lot of people, whether they're Alaska natives or whether they're not, do subsistence. They, you know, somebody that we met there said, you know, we see a bush and we see a pie. Berry picking is huge. Fishing is huge. And just how they feel about themselves as Alaskans, what brought them there in the first place for many people, is an interest in independence and freedom and being close to nature and getting to do all those things, going out on the water, going out hunting. really fascinating and so beautiful, just an incredible landscape. We were there just a couple of weeks ago, and still snow on the mountains, glacial fjords, Tongass National Forest all around. It's just spectacularly gorgeous.
And then you did a couple of stories from Nogales, which is a border town, the U.S. and Mexico, Arizona and Mexico. Is that one of those stories that you thought, we'll go and explore it from this angle, and then you discovered something else?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it was shocking and sort of embarrassing to me that I had never been to the Mexico border. It just felt like a huge gap in my understanding of this country to have never seen that, never to really understand what it meant to be on the border, to be in a place where there actually is a border fence, which Nogales, Arizona has. Just to explore what it, you know, what all this conversation about immigration, about the wall, which had been so heated during the campaign and continues to be, what it meant for people who actually live there, which is part of what I'm trying to do here, is to sometimes take bigger questions and really explore them from the perspective of a person or a community. And it's fascinating. I mean, if you live in Nogales, Arizona, or Nogales, Mexico, they're both cities on both sides of the border share a name. You go back and forth all the time. I mean, I think from a distance, it may seem that we're two very separate entities, and there's a dividing line that's hard and fixed. And obviously, if you're living on the border, it's a very, very different scenario. So people will go over to get a manicure or to get a haircut or go to Walmart and pick up a couple things that are cheaper on the United States side than they are in Mexico or vice versa. It's just very fluid. And people's identity is very mixed. And we talked to a cattle broker there who said, you know, we're all intertwined is the word he used. On the border. We have family on both sides. In fact, we have family from here who were here when this was not part of the United States, when this was part of Mexico. So there's a lot more gray than the black and white that I think we tend to see when it becomes boiled down to a political conversation in Washington.
How often do you wind up writing a different story from the one you went in expecting to write?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I think I'm always surprised, and I think if you're a good reporter with your eyes and ears open, you should be surprised all the time. I think if you go in with a preconceived idea of what that story will be, you're probably not doing yourself or your listeners a service, because that's shaped by you and not by what you're hearing on the ground. So I guess my overall approach is to go in having done research and to try to get some understanding ahead of time, obviously, of where I'm going, not be a complete blank slate, but then to let them fill in the details. And if they surprise me along the way, that's great. If they throw my preconceived notions out the window, that's a terrific thing. I'm trying to think of an example where something has been completely turned on its head. And I don't know that it's that. I think it's more subtle than that. I think it's just sort of the genuine moments when you just hear something that delights you, or something comes out of somebody's mouth that is just phrased in a way that you hadn't thought of before. That's just lovely.
When you talk about traveling, you say we.
Uh-huh.
Who are you traveling
with?
Yeah,
so I've been really lucky on this project to have a producer traveling with me. Her name is Alyssa Nadworny. She's a terrific photographer, and so she has been creating a visual counterpart to the radio stories that is really quite striking. So typically what will happen with a project like this, which are, you know, long, the trip to Alaska was a couple of weeks, so it's pretty labor intensive and a lot of traveling from place to place. So producers typically would be handling the sound recording, and then helping on the back end with shaping the story and editing the tape down and mixing it and putting the whole piece together. Alyssa has been also focused on the visual side of things, which is really nice because she's got a terrific eye. And I'd encourage people to go to npr.org and look at the Our Land page and check out the web versions of the stories, which are really quite beautiful.
Absolutely. There's some spectacular photographs.
I'll pass that along. Yeah. Thanks.
You're listening to a pre-recorded edition of Coastline. NPR special correspondent and former All Things Considered host Melissa Block is with us today. You talked about putting up pictures on the website. This is relatively new. If you look at this through the lens of a 32-year career, there are so many ways that your work landscape has probably changed
Yes.
over those
oh
decades.
My gosh, yeah.
So talk about it, since you've brought this up through the lens of technology and how reporting is different today.
Everything is different. Everything is different. So back in the day, in the dark ages, in the Pleistocene era, when I would first go out and I would be a producer, we would typically have a host and a producer and an engineer, an audio engineer, who would be carrying around a humongous, fancy, expensive, beautiful piece of recording equipment called a Nagra, which is a reel-to-reel machine, which held half an hour of tape at a time, literal reels of tape. So invariably, you'd be in the middle of something amazing and that tape would run out. And then it was a pretty elaborate process of taking that reel off and putting another one on. And bless their hearts. I mean, the sound quality back then, I think, was unparalleled. And just having a third set of hands is an amazing thing. I miss those days. I miss that collaborative approach of having an engineer out on gigs. So now we're doing more with fewer people. We have two people who go out, and now it's not just the radio story, but it's also the web version and photographs and social media component. Sometimes, not in this case, but other times things are turned into podcasts.
Do you enjoy that social media component?
I do, actually. I really do. And in fact, for the Hourland series, before we headed out, we did a call out on social media asking folks for ideas of places to go and people we should talk to. And a couple of the stories that we've ended up doing have come from that, have been generated by listener feedback. So I find that really helpful. And I also, just in terms of propagating stories for people who may not hear them on the radio, but if I put a link on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram might come to it in a different way. That's all to the good. It's time consuming. It's just another thing. I didn't mention we have a Tumblr page, so that's another sort of venue for a different kind of storytelling, a little more behind the scenes stuff.
And certainly we know if you're covering something, say, that's happening on Capitol Hill and you want to get it on the air, for all things considered, that's something that you would turn in a day.
Mm-hmm.
But what is your time frame on these stories for, say, our land?
Right. It has varied tremendously. The first story that we did was in Kansas City, and I've always wanted to go. Part of what's been great about this project is that I've been able to do things that I've always wanted to do, one of which was to go. I've always wanted to go to a naturalization ceremony for people becoming citizens, that ceremony when they're sworn in as U.S. citizens for the first time. And we found a family, an Uzbek family in Kansas City, who are about to become citizens. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to find a family who is becoming citizens right as Donald Trump is taking office as president of the United States with a new administration and new citizens? So we followed a family. And that story we turned around, I think, within 2 days. We filed that from the road. Might have been a day, something like that. Very, very quick turnaround. And we had spent the day before with them and the day of the ceremony with them. So we had a lot of tape to process and go through. That was a quickie. Others, though, have been, you know, we go out and we report and we gather tape and we bring them back. Some of the Alaska stories, you know, it might be, well, we brought 8 stories back, so we got a bit of work ahead of us. And each of them is taking a few days to put together. So spread that out over a work week, and it'll be, you know, probably another month or so before they're all done and have been on the air. So it can really depend. It also depends on, you know, not necessarily for this project, but I did a series on opioid addiction, which just involved a lot of work ahead of time in understanding the story and trying to find characters to tell it. So a lot of the work was done in advance of the actual in-the-field reporting.
Since we're talking about how the sausage is made, I actually—
It's not always pretty.
So true. Maybe it's best to not know. But a listener asked me about the production behind All Things Considered.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting the way he presented it. And this came from someone, fairly sophisticated, advanced education, local community pillar. And he basically presented it, and I'm oversimplifying it, as so the smartest minds in the world sit at the NPR anchor desk, and which I can't disagree with, and they improv the introductions to reporter pieces.
Uh-huh.
And he had this impression that so many of those excellent interviews that are done as part of All Things Considered are live, which I'm sure is a common perception among listeners. But can you talk first about the importance of writing an introduction and why everything is scripted?
Sure. Well, a lot of it is scripted, and not all, but a lot of it is scripted, partly because you want to make sure you're explaining things in a clear way and that you're not leaving out important details. I think, like that listener, before I started working at NPR, I had this image in my mind of people sort of in a big line, all the reporters standing in a big line waiting for their turn at the microphone. And one by one, sort of like a bluegrass group, they would step up and read their thing and then go away. I mean, I just had no idea, oh, things are actually recorded, things are taped. I will say that now more and more things are being done live, partly because the news is changing so fast that it really does you no good at all to tape something at 2 o'clock that's going to air at 4 when you know that something crazy is going to happen at 3:39 that will blow it completely out of the water. There's also a spontaneity to doing things live that can be very engaging. And, you know, I think editing is a wonderful tool and it gives you a more polished product. But there is an adrenaline rush and a vitality to live coverage that I've always loved and that does, I think, come through on the air. The risk is, of course, that somebody completely bogarts the conversation and just, you know, completely runs away with it and you're left with, you know, the segment's running out and you haven't gotten to the third really important question that you were hoping to ask. So that's the downside. But The roadmaps, as they're called for the shows, are now computerized. And if you look at them, when things are live, they're red. And a lot of time these days, I'm looking at the board for the shows, and there's a lot of red on those shows.
So this is changing. And this is a relatively recent change then.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's certainly, you know, we've all done a million live interviews. But and certainly if you run out of time, if something is breaking, if something's just happened, you're going live. But I just think with the pace of news and the rate at which things are developing in Washington especially, there's been a lot more live coverage lately.
Mm-hmm. I do remember observing one interview that was being taped. And this was not you. This was another NPR staff person. And it was so interesting for me to see the craft that went into pre-recording an interview. Because in this case, it was after the riots that happened in Ferguson, and a woman was kind of explaining her experience mm-hmm. to the anchor. And in this case, the anchor went back and said, okay, that story didn't make sense with the way I asked the question. It didn't have the context that you really need to hear that answer. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like writing an interview, and they went back and re-asked the question, and the woman told the story again. And it just seemed like a different animal, not lesser at all, just more carefully put together so that
It's never as good the second time, though, is it? When you have somebody repeat a story, it just never – we've all had to do it, but it's never quite as good the second time. I mean, the other thing that I would say is that I've always tried to really steer away from scripting my interviews or scripting my questions just because I think – people hear it and they think it sounds phony and they think it sounds fake. So I will go in certainly knowing things that I want to ask about and having given myself notes. But writing word for word, I think there are very few people who can pull that off. And I noticed that you're not looking at – I see you have papers in front of you. You're not looking at them. You're it also means that if you're scripting things too closely, you're not really listening to what somebody's saying. So my role as an interviewer, I think, is to be really paying attention to the moment and going in a different direction, taking the moment of surprise and running with that and trying to figure out, oh, okay, what does that mean? I mean, sometimes I think the most important question you can ask is a really simple one. It's what do you mean by that? And if you're so glued to the page and the words that you've so carefully crafted ahead of time, I think you lose those opportunities. It's really hard to do both.
Let's talk about breaking news a little bit because it was September 11th, 2001. You were in New York at the time. This was before you became co-anchor of All Things Considered, and your coverage of that helped to earn NPR a Peabody Award. Where were you when you became aware of that? Can you just kind of take us through the day as Melissa Block, the reporter?
Yeah, I was not where I wanted to be. I was in my apartment listening to the radio, getting ready to go into work, and heard on local NPR and WNYC that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. And your mind doesn't go – my mind didn't go to the worst scenario first, right? You want to think that maybe it was an aberration or an accident, and that has certainly happened of pilots getting off course. You know, that said, I had covered an earlier terrorism trial in New York where their goal had been to take down the World Trade Center. So it should – you know, that was certainly – in the back of my mind. But I didn't have my reporting equipment with me, and I lived not too far from – it would have been easy for me to get downtown. So I had to go to the NPR bureau to pick up my recording equipment to then go downtown, and it's pretty far. So it wouldn't have been a walk. I got on the subway, and then we were underground, and we were stopped, and I was nowhere. And there's nothing worse than feeling like your job is to get someplace – and you can't get there. Your impulse is you want to be there. So I was stuck underground for I don't remember how long, but it felt like hours. And I remember distinctly, finally, the subway started moving. And at this point, we knew that not one but two towers had been hit and the Pentagon had been hit. So obviously, the story was totally different from what we had hoped at the best case scenario. I remember coming up out of the subway, getting through to my editor, and saying, okay, you know, give me a fill. What's going on? And she said, oh, my God, I can't believe you got through. And I said, well, why? What's going on? She said, the Twin Towers are gone. And I said, what are you talking about? What do you mean the Twin Towers are gone? And I looked down Fifth Avenue, and there was nothing in the sky except for smoke, which is a shocking thing as a New Yorker. I mean, the Twin Towers were just a place that you could look and know where you are. They were sort of a compass point, and just to sort of digest the moment of what that meant was crazy. The footnote to this is that my soon-to-be husband, all he knew was that I was heading down to the Trade Center, and then he didn't hear from me for several hours. So it was it was horrible for him to try to figure out where I was. I was oblivious to all of that and was unable to call from the subway. So ultimately did make it downtown, And it was a couple days later that they let a group of reporters into what was not very elegantly called the pile. It was what was left of the towers, and just got a horrifying up close look at what it meant to be. I mean, they were still hoping for survivors and were carting buckets of debris in a bucket brigade off the pile. They didn't want to bring in heavy equipment in case, you know, there were still survivors. And every once in a while, there would be a moment when a dog might sniff something and everybody would pause and be still and wait, and then they'd keep digging and digging.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Our guest on this pre-recorded edition is NPR special correspondent Melissa Block. When we come back from this break, we'll finish up on September 11th and we'll find out how this NPR veteran journalist deals with the politics of the press and whether the Fourth Estate is under attack. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with NPR special correspondent Melissa Block. She's also former host of All Things Considered. She sat at the desk with co-host Robert Siegel for 12 and a half years. And Melissa Block is with us today on this Thursday. It is a pre-recorded edition of Coastline, so we are not taking listener questions on this Thursday. Melissa Block, just before we went to break, you were describing the scene on September 11th, 2001, and how frustrating it was for you to get from where you were living in New York down to the scene of what was happening. And then finally, what it was like, you said they called the wreckage, the rubbish.
The pile.
I hadn't heard that term before.
Yeah, it sounds awful, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah. And what was it about the reporting? What particular elements won NPR a Peabody Award for that?
You know, I think it I keep coming back to the notion of individual voices, and I think it was not just the global perspective that we brought to what had happened, but the individual stories. I mean, I remember the first night, you remember that so many people were desperately trying to find their loved ones, right? I mean, thousands of people were in those buildings, and people were going from hospital to hospital and putting up posters. I mean, it was just heartbreaking everywhere you turned. And I remember meeting a woman outside a hospital downtown, and I can still hear her voice in my head. And she expressed the notion of, you know, what it still chokes me up to even think about this. She said, what if he's alive? What if he's in pain and I can't hold his hand? And I think moments like that just bring stories home to people in a very direct way. It's maybe it's hard to fathom thousands of people being killed at one time, but it is very easy to understand and relate to someone expressing that thought. Who wouldn't understand exactly what that terror feels like and that pain? I think it was much the same, shifting gears a little bit. You mentioned the earthquake in China in 2008, and we did a story about a couple whom we happened to meet in a town that was really horribly destroyed in the earthquake. And their child, their two-year-old child, was missing along with his grandparents, and they were desperate to find him. And they had finally gotten a piece of heavy equipment to come and try to excavate the building that they knew he was in that had collapsed. And we spent the day with them. And ultimately, at the end of, I think it was 9 hours that we spent with them, their bodies were found and they were dead. And the story was a very visceral. I mean, you hear me emoting in the story. I'm narrating as we're going and as we're learning things with them. It's certainly more emotional than any other story I've ever done. And the pain in their voice, and when she described it, the mom described that she was going to work that morning and her son begged her, please don't go to work, not knowing anything, of course, but just he didn't want his mom to go to work. And as a new mom myself, and hearing that sentiment, and just thinking about just every tragic aspect of that story sort of boiled down into this one family. But listeners, my point being that listeners responded to that because it was one story out of so many tens of thousands of people who died. This one moment, this one story, and spending a concentrated amount of time with these people to try to understand their life and what this moment meant for them, it really hit home for people and for listeners in a direct way.
And this is one of the things that makes you such a great anchor and wonderful correspondent, is you have it's a tangible empathy that comes through when you're talking to someone.
Oh, thank you.
And so you've got the empathy going on, but you don't get sucked in. You're still able to sort of be the objective correspondent.
I wasn't very objective on that day, I have to say. I think all objectivity flew out the window.
That was part of the story then, though. I mean, that was a time when, as a reporter, it was completely appropriate and right. It would have been artificial for you to be just that objective,
yeah.
You know, here I'm reporting,
right.
This is what's happened. How do you deal with that when, and I don't know if you encounter this a lot now because you're not covering politics directly, but how do you deal with that when you have strong feelings about a story and you know you have to remain the objective voice and you can't insert yourself?
Well, that's our role. I mean, we're talking about two very different things,
yes.
I think, right? So
yes.
A very visceral emotional experience versus a political conversation or discussion in which I may have views or I may not, but I think our...
But do you ever have a visceral emotional experience when you're talking about a political issue?
You know, I think I've always been able to put... I mean, I hate to use the word blinders because it sounds like you're ignoring things, but I think as a reporter you have to be able to set a lot of things aside and really be a listener and not... It's not about me. It's not about anything that I may think or feel, except for to the extent that it shapes the questions I might ask or the approach that I might take in trying to get to the bottom of something. And I think that's our role, is to ask tough questions, no matter who it is, but to really hold people to account, to get them to explain their positions, and to challenge them when things don't make sense.
Do you think that journalists today, and I'm talking today as in 2017, mm-hmm. since the presidential election, are having to learn a new way of covering an administration? That there's been so much talk about fake news and discrediting the press, and you know, there's been talk from President Donald Trump about limiting press access,
yeah.
and limiting even the number of briefings,
yeah.
that are held.
Well, look, I think it's a challenge. It's a huge challenge for anybody trying to cover Washington right now and to cover the administration right now, frankly, because there's so many contradictory messages that are coming out and so many contradictory explanations from one day to another. We saw it with the explanation of why James Comey was fired. You know, it flipped 180 degrees in the course of a day. That's not the reporter's interpretation. That is what is directly coming from the White House. I do think I have great empathy for my friends on the Washington desk at NPR right now. My office sits right near their pod of people. And I'll be busy in my office working on some story about Southeast Alaska. And I'll start hearing a rumble, a hubbub. And pretty soon I realize something huge has happened. And the other day it was the Comey firing. And I'll hear them sort of shouting from desk to desk. And, you know, immediately weekend plans are blown out of the water. Your kids' recital is blown out of the water. I mean, they are working nonstop. And look, NPR has grown tremendously in the time I've been there, but we don't have the huge resources, say, of the New York Times or the Washington Post. So these people are working around the clock, literally, to try to get a grip on what's going on in Washington right now. And in terms of being held to account, I mean, I do think that there is a lot more, and I think it's to the good of reporting. I think there is a lot more fact-checking going on. I think reporters realize and have realized for quite some time that nothing can be taken at face value and that things need to be backed up with facts. And the reporting reflects that. Whether people are listening to that reporting is another question.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. NPR special correspondent and former All Things Considered host Melissa Block is with us on this Thursday. We have heard from listeners here in this market about the coverage of Donald Trump. And to be fair, the listener complaints have tapered off. But the flavor of the complaint was generally every single day you're attacking the president. Mm-hmm. Why is NPR spending all this time trying to take apart what Donald Trump is trying to do? Because the people who voted for him voted for radical change. They voted for a way of doing things that was unprecedented.
It's an interesting point. I mean, I think I think the administration has created its own narrative in a lot of ways. I think blaming the press for covering an administration that is as complicated as this one has been and which has so many issues right now is misguided. I will say, though, I mean, I'm thinking of a gentleman I just met in Southeast Alaska, and I don't even remember how we started talking about Donald Trump. I think he may have brought it up. And he said, he was clearly a Trump supporter and expressing how much he liked him. And he said, you know, I don't care what he's doing. He's doing something. And I heard that and I thought, okay, well, I don't know that I agree with that. I think it should matter what someone is doing. But I think it's important for me to keep in mind that there are a lot of people around the country who agree with that, who wanted something to feel like change. Maybe they weren't even sure what kind of change it was that they wanted, but that they are banking on something happening in Washington right now that will feel different to them. And I think just being aware of those voices, being mindful of those voices is really helpful to me to understand how people might be receiving the news. But to your listeners who are concerned about the tone of coverage or the pace of coverage, I think I don't see signs of that letting up. I mean, I think this is an administration that is very different from any others that we've covered before. And if you think about it just being, you know, a little over 100 days in and this is where we are, it gives you pause. It gives you pause. So, but it's important. I mean, I would also say to those listeners, look, this is important. This is the future of our country at a very divided time, and it's really important that we not be ignoring anything that's going on.
And to me, this sounds like a luxury. It sounds wonderful to be able to travel and meet someone and just enter their universe for a day or a couple of hours. Can you talk about what that's like when you meet someone that you wouldn't, you know, your paths wouldn't normally cross unless you were seeking out a person from that particular part of the world or part of this country?
Yeah.
What is that like? And what do you learn when you're willing to kind of set aside your preconceptions about the guy who's a fisherman in Alaska, or the person who's working as a manicurist in Nogales, Mexico.
Right. It's fascinating. I mean, we spent one of the profiles that we did was with a pig farmer in Independence, Iowa, just outside Independence, Iowa. It just felt like if we were going to Iowa, we should talk about farming, and pig farming came up, and I thought, well, that would be interesting. I've never seen that, and you know, a man who's very proud of the work that he does, works super hard, and it's dirty work and it's smelly work, but he actually has separate washing machine for his work clothes because they do not commingle with the family wear clothes for good reason. I'm always grateful, and working for NPR, I do think gives us a special entree to people because they feel like they trust us and they feel like they know us in a very intimate way. I mean, we're with them. You know, you're not glued to a screen when you're listening to us. You're doing your life. We're in your bathroom. We're in your kitchen. We're in your car with your kids. So I think people feel a connection to us if they listen, and overwhelmingly they do. So they let us into their life in really interesting ways. And also, it's not an obtrusive thing. There's not a big video camera in their face all the time. Radio is a pretty economic and nimble medium. So to be able to spend time with him, or we went out canoeing on the Mississippi River with a river guide who in the Mississippi Delta, who takes kids who, look, they live right next to one of the great American rivers and never go out on it. It's seen as a dangerous thing. And his mission in part is to get these kids out on the river. So we had just a lovely day paddling with him and talking about the river. I mean, how amazing and fun is that to be at the post office in a little tiny town in Alaska when the mail plane comes in? We actually rode in on the mail plane and to explore what the life is of somebody who's basically the only game in town, the postmistress in Myers-Chuck, Alaska.
Have you ever had to walk into an interview where you thought ahead of time, I'm not going to like this person. I'm really not, but I'm going to have to set that aside. Or does that just not happen with you?
I almost think it's often been, not often, just a couple of times, been the reverse. And I think this is the peril of having heroes or having idols. There have been a couple interviews of musicians whom I completely revere as musicians, and the interviews have been total duds. totally
Why?
Disappointing.
What makes them a dud?
Loopy thought, unable to complete a sentence. I don't know if it was, you know, too much loud music in their ears at an early age. I don't know. But, you know, people whose lyrics make you think that there is some, you know, hugely powerful narrative brain at work, and there is, but in that moment, as I'm sitting with them for some whatever short-circuited reason, it's not happening, and that is hugely disappointing, and so a cautionary tale that everybody has either bad days or is not, you know, maybe they are an incredible lyricist but not a great talker, or maybe I was having a bad day and wasn't able to draw them out, but I'm trying to think if there are people I did not expect to like who I've ended up liking. And I guess maybe it's just me being a Pollyanna. I guess I always sort of assume that people are worthy and people are worth listening to, and that I can learn something from them. I think if you go in hostile, you're probably not going to get much out of it.
You interviewed Clyde Edgerton.
I did, twice.
And we know him here,
yes,
as a legendary author. He's written 10 novels, three of which have been made into movies. He's the Thomas S. Keenan Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing, UNCW. You most recently, I think it was for his book of advice, Papa Daddy's Book for New Fathers.
Yes.
We're a little proprietary
especially,
here when it comes to Clyde
Edgerton. Especially geared to the, I believe he called it, the considerably older dad,
yes,
the COD. Yes.
And you spent a lot of time laughing in that interview.
Well, how can you not? He's hysterical.
How do you know when has it been a good interview? When do you know that it hasn't just been bonding,
yeah,
but that you've actually been able to pull something out of your guest?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess two things. One, I mean, anytime I can fall out of my chair laughing in an interview, I think it's a good interview, obviously, depending on the topic. Sometimes it's what I hear afterward, which is the guest maybe saying, oh, I hadn't really thought about that before. Or maybe it's a publicist saying, I've never heard him tell that story before. I learned something today that I hadn't learned. Those are great moments. I can think of interviews where I was practically moved to tears by what I was hearing. And I remember one in particular. We did a series on winter songs. We had people talk about a winter song that had great meaning to them. And Bill T. Jones, a choreographer and dancer, told a remarkable story about his father, and listening to a certain piece of music that evoked his father, a very painful memory of seeing his father walking through a snowstorm. And I remember looking into the control room and seeing my producer, and both of our jaws, just sort of every moment of that interview when he was talking, our jaws dropped lower and lower. It was painful, but it was also magical. And those moments you treasure forever.
And that's this edition of Coastline. We need another hour. Melissa Block, what a pleasure.
I'll come back. So great to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being on. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.